And it is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Pretty hot today out there, Bonnie.
A little bit, but we have a solution for that.
In the second part of our program. Indeed, we do. Well, we begin today with zoologist and marine biologist Dr. Gary Schmelz. He's written Journey to the Edge of Eden, which chronicles and reflects on the emotional bond he's made with Southwest Florida and the lasting recollections of encountering its beauty with his father Henry. Gary Schmelz was born in New Jersey but began his love of Florida in 1970, and he joins us from Naples. Welcome to you, Dr. Gary Schmelz.
I'm glad to be here, Joseph and Bonnie.
Great to have you.
Oh, yeah. Anxious to, you know, it's been a great ride in Florida, and there's a lot of beautiful things both my dad and I experienced here in the area, and especially when he moved down here in the mid-1970s, we got a chance to explore some of those exciting places, especially in the Southwest Florida area, in the 10,000 Islands and the Fakahatchee and parts of the Everglades.
Well, let's begin with your dad. He played such an important role in your book, mm-hmm. which is really beautifully written. As well as your life. Yes, and in your life, I was adding. He had a really tragic childhood, though. Tell us about him in his early years, will you?
Yeah, he did have a tragic childhood. His parents migrated over here in the 1800s, and you know, they expected the bright, new, shiny world that they were going to enter, and things didn't quite turn out that way. Although his father was well educated, he wasn't able to get a job, and ultimately they had a large family and not a lot of money to take care of the family. And the father lost his wife and couldn't tolerate the loss of that wife. It was so bad for him, and he killed himself. And my father wound up in institutions to take care of him, and finally wound up in a foster home. And as a result of being in a foster home, the person actually used him as slave labor and had him work on the farm, never sent him to school, and was always punishing him for things, small things that he did. And finally, one day, he caught my father in the barn using matches and thought he was going to set the barn on fire. And so the foster parent actually strung him up in the barn and used a bullwhip on him and took all the flesh off of his back and just left him hanging there. And except for the screams that my father gave and a neighbor who came to his rescue and took him away, he would have, you know, I think he would have probably died. But, you know, that was a scar that he carried for the rest of his life. Whenever we would go fishing, he had to keep his shirt on and protect himself from the sun because everything would open up and it would bleed. And I remember one day my mother told me, you know, please, you know, protect him, you know, tell him to keep his shirt on. And I forgot to do it. And I you know, I've regretted that after that day. You know, it was my responsibility and I didn't do it. So.
And your mother, Katie, had her own issues, severe depression.
Yeah, she did. She didn't have an easy life. It was one where she was actually repeatedly raped together with her sister by the father, and she and her sister left the home early to just get out of the home environment. And unfortunately for my mother, the person that she eventually did marry became very obsessed and jealous of her and kept her in a room and threatened her to kill her if she left. So finally my mother left that home, and she lived by herself and with a friend for quite some time until she later met my father.
And how did they meet, your mom and dad?
They met actually through he was working at an A&P, one of the old grocery stores, where he was a clerk, and of course he had very little education himself, so, you know, he couldn't find very lucrative jobs, and he began trying, you know, to help her with stuff when she came into the store, and finally she agreed to go out on a date with him. And
it took a while.
Yeah, it took a while. It wasn't something that she was not too anxious to hook up with another person, and she was, you know, very reluctant. She told my father, well, no, no, and then finally she said, well, if I'm never going to get rid of him if I don't say yes, and so finally she did, and it turned out, you know, favorable for me. I'm here now as a result of that union.
And when did you know that environmental science was your passion?
You know, it, being born in the city, it wasn't something that came right away. It developed over time, and eventually through my father's love of fishing and going out on the ocean to go crabbing and things of that nature, he took the time. I guess I was about 9 or 10 years old when he first started taking me out fishing, and then he would always spend some time taking us to the shore, and when the tide was out, we would stroll along the beaches and look at the different critters that were there, and that resulted in a lot of questions on my part, and some of the answers, of course, he just didn't have the answers to, but I have to give him credit. He actually got me to the point where we would go to bookstores, and we'd get books and try to identify some of the different critters that we were finding along the beaches, and actually trying to identify some of the fish that we were catching as well. And that led to my interest in marine biology, actually. And when I got into high school and then finally into college, I started to direct my career towards an interest in biology and then ultimately into environmental studies.
I like that you're a zoologist and a marine biologist, and yet you use the term critters.
Oh, yeah.
You're not giving us any of that Latin stuff going on.
Oh, no, I won't tell you what Archaeocephalus verbatocephalus is, the sheep said.
Oh, thank you. So what was this with the Navy? Your father was in the Navy, and then you joined. You followed his footsteps. Why? Is that why you did?
Not really, of course. I had finished college, and, you know, at that time, after you finished your undergraduate studies, you had to enlist in the military, unless you were in the upper 10%. I think I was in about the 19th or 18th percent of my class, and you wanted to go on for graduate studies. So it really turned out to be a situation where I had to do my duty for my country, and it was a decision that I'd go into the same branch of service as my father, which was the Navy. So, and that's basically what happened. I served my time.
And what year was that? What year was that? Excuse me.
We were back in the 1960s. The Vietnam War was just beginning to, you know, build up, and I thought when I was in the service that they would send me over to Vietnam, and it turned out they put me on after they actually let me finish my graduate studies in a master's degree, and then told me I had to serve, but they put me on a research vessel that was out of Philadelphia, and the purpose of that ship, it turned out, was to study the ocean bottom, so that they could lay cables across the ocean bottom to detect submarines that were coming out of Russia.
Boy, you were fortunate.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I, you know, the people that were ahead of me getting called up, they were put on an aircraft carrier and sent down to Guantanamo for a shakedown cruise, and then finally sent over to Nam.
So you were raised in this urban environment, and you vacationed on the Cape as a youngster, but it really seems like your love affair with nature begins in Southwest Florida in 1970 on Tiger Tail Beach on Marco Island. What brought you down there?
You know, I I got a job in Florida, and I worked for the Deltona Corporation. And there was the at the time, there weren't a lot of jobs. A lot of the money was being sucked out of the country and went into the war effort. And I was, you know, looking for a job. I had graduated with a doctorate from the University of Delaware, and I was I had a job opportunity in New Zealand, it turned out, but then they had lost some of their funding because of the war, and I was looking at other places as well, and a job opportunity came over for Deltona, and they were looking for a chief aquatic ecologist, and sound like a job that was really interesting to me, and I was going to go down and advise Deltona as to what they could do as far as the development was concerned on Marco Island, and that led me to coming to Florida. The job didn't last too long. It was an interesting event, but it really got me involved in learning about the Southwest Florida area and all the wonderful environments that were here. I mean, I just was overwhelmed. It was just coming from an old world into another world that was fantastic.
You talked about that you first came to Miami, or you had some time in Miami, and in the book you talked about that you stayed at a Holiday Inn. It wouldn't have been the one at I-95 and 79th Street, was it?
You know, I don't exactly remember that the address, but it was the Deltona Corporation actually had a facility, a room that they had set aside for people that were working with the company, and that's where we would stay when we came over. And we would come over for different activities if there were challenges to from environmental groups that were concerned about what was happening on Marco, then we would have meetings over here in Miami, and we would stay at that Holiday Inn.
So you were on the corporate side at that time?
Yes, that's right. Mm.
So how has Marco Island changed since 1970 environmentally?
Oh, it's changed considerably. Initially, the history of Marco was they wanted to take the island and make it a preserve, but that never materialized, and so eventually, after Deltona had been successful over on Key Biscayne, they took a chance and they purchased the land on Marco to set up what they thought was going to be, you know, one of the greatest coastal developments in Florida. And they went ahead with that program. And they got into trouble basically with the Army Corps of Engineers with some of the procedures that they were going ahead with, and some of the canals that they were digging. There were questions about how the canals were being made and how flushing was actually impacting some of the areas around the island. And my job in particular was to advise them as to whether or not they were doing the right thing as far as those canals were concerned. And we also had a parallel program that was being partially run out of the University of Miami with Bernie Yokel. We were to do parallel studies around Marco with those that were occurring in natural areas in Rookery Bay. And our trawls and our water samples all were to be pulled together and to perform an analysis that would determine what the impact of the Deltona development was having upon the entire region.
And what was that impact?
That impact, from what I was able to determine, were they one of the questions that was put forth to us is, were they digging the canals at a uniform depth, and was there adequate flow through the canal systems that they were making to allow for satisfactory exchange of water, oxygenated water through the systems? And it turned out that they weren't exactly following those guidelines. And they had an old Army Corps of Engineer person, if I remember his name, his name was Colonel Feeman, and you know, we sat in his office one day and we asked him, you know, what were you doing there with the canal? He said, well, we can't dig these canals uniformly. because we can't get enough sediment. And they were taking the sediment from the bottom of the canals and, of course, then using that as the basis for putting houses. So they, you know, like we'd have with quarries today, you'd get fill and you'd raise the level of the home, and then you'd put the home on top of that. Well, they were just taking their fill from the bottom of the canals, and they'd get to a real muddy place where, you know, the sediment wasn't satisfactory, and they'd go down 20, 25 feet. And they were supposed to stay at a more uniform level, maybe 15 feet. And but in this case, they were creating what they called pockets or dead zones. And there was no exchange of oxygen in these dead zones. And when they got flushed, if there was a storm coming to Marco and those areas were flushed, then it would take out this sediment, this anaerobic sediment, this sediment without oxygen. It just throw it out into the surrounding areas around Marco Island and actually create a problem for the fish and other wildlife were there, because you have this low oxygen zone and you'd create populations of dead fish and crabs as a result of this flushing action.
So did they end up being able to develop it and build those houses?
A good portion of them were developed, but the actual project was stopped on the south side of Marco. So, and they also had a project on Marco Shores, which in their particular case, they had actually promised that they weren't going to really do any extensive development over there. But it turned out that their plans were to go ahead and put hotels, and they were going to be right next to what is now the Rookery Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve. And so there was a lot of concern on the part of Audubon, National Audubon, and the Conservancy of Southwest Florida about what was happening there. And I couldn't, I didn't know what was really going on, because in some cases they just didn't tell me. And I went over to actually their office, their real estate office, and went with a friend, and we just kind of said, well, if we wanted to buy a piece of property over there on Marco Shores, could we do that? And they said no initially, and then I said, well, I understood from so and so that there was some, you know, something going on of that nature, and sure enough. When they said, well, you can come in the back room. So we went in the back room, and that's when I became aware that, yes, they were going to go ahead with the developments on Marco Shores. And I was just totally unaware of that when it was happening. So it was kind of a shock to me, because I thought, you know, hey, we were working together, and we were not going to do things without, you know, getting the official permission. And we weren't going to, do things that were other people felt that we shouldn't be doing. So.
We heard you say, Dr. Gary Schmelz, Marco Shores, there's a little bit of New Jersey still left even after all these years. But I was wondering if you could tell us some of the stories from your 18 years at the Nature Center and Conservatory of Southwest Florida.
Yeah. Well, after I left Deltona, my next job wound up eventually being at the Big Cypress Nature Center, and that was those were pretty exciting years for me, because I realized that one of the things that was needed to be done was to make the public aware of some of the things that were happening, and also the importance education would play in the role of children, to get them as they were growing up to appreciate their environment and to understand, you know, some of the environmental issues that they would eventually face as South Florida began to develop. And so the Big Cypress Nature Center job, I guess it was about 4 months after I left Deltona that I got the job, and I actually began teaching as an interpretive naturalist for the Nature Center.
That was quite a switch from what you were doing.
Oh, absolutely! It was a cultural shock.
Yes.
I had to my very first teaching assignment was to go out to Immokalee. And Immokalee is, you know, well inland from Naples, Florida, where the Nature Center, or close to where the Nature Center was. And I got there, and I discovered I had to drive a school bus to pick the children up. They didn't have a school bus that was working or in great condition. And I had to drive that school bus to my first school, and I can remember the school bus had a hole that ran down the center of the bus. And it was filled with cinder blocks that they were using the bus for building purposes. So the you know, whenever something needed to be constructed, they would just throw the cinder blocks in the bus. Well, this is the only bus they had, so off I took in this bus, and of course the cinder blocks started falling off the seats onto the floor. Some of them fell through the holes in the center of the bus, and I got...
Sounds like a dangerous ride.
and the bus only had two gears. It had first and fifth, so, you know, when you shifted it, it didn't glide into anything. It lurched into the next event, so... Oh, and I worked with the children out in Immokalee, and it was a real eye opener. For me, to see that situation, the children out there, many of them, I took them to the beach, had never been to the beach, and in fact, black children weren't allowed, as far as I knew, on the beach in Naples in 1970. Mm. So. And I
it's pretty incredible.
I'm naive, you know, and I was really naive. I didn't realize that. And a teacher says to me, do you really think you want to take the children to the beach? And I said, why not, you know? I said, they should all enjoy the beach. And, they just didn't have dog children down here on the beach. And I said, well, I don't care. I said, I'm going to take them to the beach. So... we got there, and some of those black children, you know, they hadn't ever seen the Gulf of Mexico. And a couple of them, when we got down to the beach, they ran down there, and they started drinking water because they were thirsty.
Oh, my.
And
the salt water?
The salt water, yeah, right. And I said to them, they came back to me, and they said, oh, this place is polluted, you know. And I said, no, it's an ocean, you know. And that just the concept of the idea that there is an ocean out there, and it's different from the lakes that they, like Lake Trafford that was close by to them, was totally foreign to them. I mean, it was just amazing. And also to realize how hungry these children were. I mean, they would prepare big lunches for them. So when we went on a field trip, they'd have food to eat, but there were things that happened that were just amazing. I met this one young man, and he was shooting robins, and he was shooting them to bring home to his family to eat. And I just came up to him and I said, "Well, what do you have? I have a bag full of birds." I said, "What are you going to eat?" He said, "I'm going to bring them home to my parents to eat." Mm. He says, we had a situation where the children, I would bring animals into the classroom, and gopher tortoises were one of them that I would bring in, and I'd show them the gopher tortoises and talk about them. Then I'd bring them back to the little preserve we had at the Nature Center after the program. But on one occasion, I left them there overnight, and the turtle was gone. The tortoise was gone. I said, "Well, what happened to this?" You know, and then one of the little girls stood up and she was crying and she said, "Oh," she said, "so and so ate the turtle. He took it home and ate it."
My. Well, Dr. Gary Schmelz, it's really a beautiful book. The name is Journey to the Edge of Eden.
And we'll have links at our website and also the Facebook page.
And also the Facebook. Do you have a specific website yourself that we can put up?
No, I don't, unfortunately. I've just not gotten to that. I regret that, but, you know.
Well, good for you.
And I'm glad you're doing such good work. Are you still the director of education for the Conservancy?
No, I'm retired from that job, although I still work with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, you know, and they sell some of the books. I've done wildflower books, and they sell those, and I do programs for them. We go out on wildflower walks together, and we do hikes to look at the geology, and we collect fossils and talk about Florida's ancient environments, and do all kinds of things with them.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you today.
Certainly,
and the best of luck with the book and with conservation, environmental conservation in Southwest Florida.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Okay. Food and Dining is next.
And welcome back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, it's another hot, muggy South Florida afternoon. I know I've started out the last segment with that, but it's really incredible now here in late July, and don't expect any relief for months, of course. Then again, there's always ice cream to consider, especially the creamy, unique, homemade variety. Linda Gassenheimer is here, and we have a truly stupendous sample of ice creams before us. Ooh.
Whoa, it's all about ice cream today, Joseph Cooper. Did you know that July is National Ice Cream Month? You know, it's one of America's favorite comfort foods. Creamy, smooth, rich. It'll make anyone's bad day feel a lot better. And we've been gorging ourselves here feeling a lot better.
Speak for yourself.
And some more.
I saw you having triples and quadruples, Bonnie Berman. Well, in 1984, President Ronald Reagan declared July National Ice Cream Month. Here to help us celebrate is Rosa Mexicano's regional executive chef, James Cawley. They're having a special ice cream festival there. Yummy. Let's welcome James Cawley. Welcome, James.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us, especially since you filled the studio with this wonderful ice cream. And of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What's your favorite ice cream story, or do you have some ice cream questions for Chef James? Call us. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Do we have email?
We do. radio@WLRN.org. We also have Twitter. It's at Topical Currents.
Okay. And of course, our favorite wine guy is with us, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. And you can read Fred's wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns, but you can also read his wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, are we going to have wine with ice cream?
Well, I don't know. That's kind of a hard thing to come up with, so I'll have to see what I can do, but I don't know.
Especially with some of the flavors we have here.
I put my money on Fred.
So
what
do
you think?
Well, you know, it's so National Ice Cream Month, but it's also National Tequila Day within a couple of days from now. So we'll
yesterday.
Think of something.
It was yesterday, Fred. Okay. Chef James Cawley, Rosa Mexicana is having their ice cream festival, but is ice cream popular in Mexico?
It is in a sense where the snow cones, which we're doing on our menu for the first time, that's really one of the essences of wonderful street ice snow cones. So what we're doing at the restaurant to really, as a traditional way, is having snow cone stations brought out to the dining room and doing snow cones right at the table
side. So what are you putting in your snow cones?
You're going to have a different array of flavors. And what we're going to do is a guava, chili, and arbol huckleberry.
Wait. Guava, chili, arbol?
That's right.
Huckleberry? Okay. Next one?
Or you could have, it's actually going to be a combination. So we're going to have multiple flavors, and you'll be able to choose. So such as a mocha caramel horchata and mango mint and chili. And toppings is strawberry compote, shaved Mexican chocolate. So it's really up to you. We shave the ice, you pick the flavor.
Whoa, okay. Now, we've been telling everybody But all this wonderful ice cream we're tasting. So let's taste it again and tell us.
Yeah.
Yeah, where everyone's waiting.
Yes, what happened to James that he's over there now? He used to be next to me.
No, I put him next to me. Sorry. This is ice cream.
I see,
yes.
Linda. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, you have to watch
I
out
see
now.
The way you've changed the... I didn't hear the music stop from musical chair. He was here.
Okay. Well, he's got his spoon ready to give you some ice cream.
Okay.
So what's the first one you're digging out there?
Well, the first one is one of our features. It's an avocado ice cream that we're going to actually be making tableside in a guacamole-type setting where we'll have the guacamole carts at the table. But instead of using avocados, obviously, for guacamole, we're using avocado ice cream and all the flavors that will go into it, such as we'll have white chocolate chips, we'll have strawberries, we'll have raspberry sauce, we'll have hot fudge, and we'll have chiffonade mitt, which would take place actually of a cilantro. So in the essence, it's like a guacamole, but instead it's a guacamole avocado ice cream dessert, basically.
So what's this black thing you've got on this?
The black thing is a mocajete. That's a lava rock. And what we're going to do is basically just put the...
Wow.
Avocado ice cream.
Now, this is a green color ice cream.
Very light
green. Right, the green from the avocados.
Right, and yeah. Then and then yes. You're putting into that.
Makes
go ahead.
Makes sense.
So then you're going to add all your flavors.
Let's go put the almonds and...
No, that's the white chocolate chips. And then
white chocolate chips.
Some fudge.
Oh, my God.
Some mint.
Uh-huh. And he's mixing this all in this...
Mocajete.
Mocajete. Which,
and the strawberries.
Which you usually at this restaurant make... Guacamole.
It's sort of like a mortar.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, right. Okay.
And then you're going to mix all that up.
All right. So no, stop the mixing and let's eat.
Okay. So
it's mixed
okay.
Enough.
Some of that.
All right. And
and that's also going to be served with buñuelos, which are crispy tortillas with cinnamon sugar. And that acts as your chip for like a guacamole.
Okay.
You, have.
You stop spooning the
I'm
ice
sorry.
Cream out. You have to watch him every minute, right? That's why I'm sitting next to him.
We have a few unique flavors that we want to talk about as well.
Oh, my.
Something that you might not, you know, recognize as a very nice flavor is a Mexican sour gherkin and jalapeno sorbet.
Mm-hmm.
But what you get when you taste it is a really palate-cleansing, very refreshing sorbet with a little bit of a hint of spice. So it's coming off of a really hot day like this. You'll try the sorbet. And it might sound to you like it's going to be an awkward flavor, but turn, it's actually really
refreshing. I'm eating this avocado ice cream,
mm-hmm.
And I've got them. It's just delicious, but that little hint of mint,
yes,
that
makes all the difference.
The fresh mint.
And now I'm eating. This is
the Mexican. That's the Mexican sour gherkin. It's like a little watermelon. If you could imagine a little petite watermelon the size of your thumb. It's really got a cucumber type flavor.
Wait, Bonnie's leaving her mic so she could go over and get some more ice cream.
Oh. No, I wanted the gherkin.
Oh, the gherkin. Oh, this one, okay.
You know, I thought it wasn't going to be very good. I have to be honest here. But
this is like the old house party.
But it's so refreshing and delicious. Very icy because it's a sorbet. And a beautiful green color.
It is refreshing, like watermelon,
right?
Or cucumbers. It tastes like what is that? A cucumber soup, a cold cucumber soup. But it's much more refreshing.
One of the other flavors we have.
Go ahead.
One of the other flavors that we have is a sweet cream with a cajeta, which is a goat's milk caramel, and a hot fudge. So we have two different swirls in the ice cream.
It's a goat milk caramel. Goat milk caramel.
Right.
Oh, wait, I'm just going to dig right in here.
Go ahead.
Right, okay. They can wait. They can wait.
Thanks.
Thanks, Linda.
Now I have to give her another napkin.
Yeah, I just dripped.
She's got it running down her chin.
No, I do not. So this is... It's got this... Go ahead. They're waiting.
Oh, okay. So that's just the ice creams that we're doing. So, you know, this year we're also offering paletas and paleta.
No, we need to tell people what a paleta is.
A paleta is a popsicle. So
okay.
We're doing different flavors of popsicles that we're offering for the first time, this, as well as the raspados, the shaved ice that we're doing. The paletas are arroz con leche and peach. So we have a two flavor.
Sorry, arroz con leche?
Putting
rice in the ice cream?
That's correct. Like you make a rice milk, and then you with the rice, and then you fill the popsicle container up halfway, and then you let that freeze, and then you fill it up with peach, and then you let that freeze, and you put the stick in it.
You mean kind of like a chocolate with rice in it, like crunchy?
No,
it gets crunchy.
He makes the milk out of it,
like with rice flour.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And a papaya and passion fruit. So again, two flavors. We're just filling up the popsicle container halfway, letting it freeze, and then adding the other flavor. Adding the other flavor.
Okay. We have a caller here. Let's take it's Matt in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a suggestion with ice cream. I love ice cream, and I also love clouds. And if you have a real fluffy ice cream, when you take a bite, look up at a big, beautiful cloud. It'll make it all the much better.
you look at the cloud while you're eating the ice cream?
Yeah, that's a transcendent.
That sounds like a great new yoga position.
Oh, Fred, I'm so sorry you're not here tasting all this delicious ice cream.
You guys realize I'm sitting here ice creamless.
Well, Fred, you're always welcome to come.
Why don't you run to the freezer, Fred, and get some of your own?
Yes,
I think I'll go back to the tequila.
Some plain old vanilla.
No, I just had to have some more of this. What's this thing I'm eating here?
That is a sweet cream with the fudge and the swirl.
The swirl. Delicious. Mm. It's really very good. Okay, so now, you also have, by the way, when does this ice cream festival start?
It starts next Wednesday.
And it goes through?
August 25th. It's served at all of our locations.
So name some of your locations so that people who are drooling here, they might want to.
Locally, we're in South Beach on Lincoln Road, 1119 Lincoln Road, right across from the movie theater, and in Mary Brickell Village, 900 South Miami Avenue.
Okay. Well, can they come in and just have the ice cream and not the rest?
That's right. You could just come in and have just a paleta, just a popsicle if you wanted.
Oh, yum. All right. Okay. Now, here's something else I was surprised to find. You have an ice cream stuffed churros? First of all, a churros is like a stringy donut.
That's correct.
How are you stuffing it with ice cream?
So we pre-scoop the ice cream out and put it in the freezer. And then when we're ready to fry it, we make a sopapilla dough. Which is a little bit lighter when you're making a dough. It's a very easy to play with dough. So what we're going to do is put the ice cream into the dough, wrap it up, and then fry it. It comes out a little bit.
So you fry the dough, and the ice cream stays frozen, hopefully.
That's correct, yes. That's the plan.
So you better eat it right away.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, and we didn't mention, we have to go to a break in a second, but we've got these ice cream cones here.
Right, we're also offering, yes, if you'd like an ice cream cone with your selection of ice creams, you could have a Mexican and vanilla papita homemade ice cream cone.
Ooh.
Mm. Oh, that's delicious. Well, we're going to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking about National Ice Cream Month with Chef James Colley. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. We're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we've been talking about July, National Ice Cream Month. We've been gorging ourselves on these wonderful ice creams. Helping us celebrate is Rosa Mexicano Regional Executive Chef James Colley. I'm drooling here still because I got this wonderful ice cream cone at the break. The Mexican restaurant chain is having an ice cream festival, and we've been tasting their amazing treats. But on another note, here's a chance if you want to help fight childhood hunger across America, and that's tonight. Share Our Strength is now called Taste of the Nation, South Florida, and they have their benefit tonight at the Lowe's Hotel, Miami Beach. It goes on from 7 to 10 p.m. Over 50 restaurants with wines and spirits. It's really an important event, and 100% of the ticket sales go to Share Our Strength. So a really important event. For more information, you can go to tasteofthenation.org. With dinner in minutes, I thought we'd have, I just would like to have the ice cream for my dinner.
However, go along with that, too.
However,
we'll just forget it, then.
No, it's Mexican. We got a Mexican dinner here. It's a turkey and mushroom quesadilla. The variety of textures and flavors, the earthy, meaty mushrooms, soft cheese, crisp tortillas, and it makes a really quick, tasty meal. And then to go with it, we have a corn and black bean salad. It's really simple. You saute the mushrooms until they're soft. You add a little spinach and it melts. Take that out of the pan. Don't have to wash the pan. Use the same pan. Spray it with a little olive oil and then crisp up the tortilla in it. Put the mushrooms back and spinach back in the tortilla. Put some cheese on it. Fold it over. Turn it over. put a cover on for a second to melt the cheese. It's so easy to make. It's really, and it'd be great if you have it with this ice cream.
In 15 minutes?
Joe, I'll give you another 5 minutes.
Okay.
Sure. Okay. So for the corn and black bean salad, just defrost corn kernels, add some rinsed drained black beans and some salad dressing, mix that all together. And that whole recipe and a photo is at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Okay, Fred, I bet on you for wine here. So what's going on?
Well, you know, wine and ice cream, that's I don't know. I think Bonnie and Joe will back me up on this. When Linda chooses her topic, she always tries to find something impossible to match with wine.
Thank you, Fred.
She'll invite the lady who runs the elementary school lunch program, and I'm supposed to come up with a wine with that? It's kind of like Click and Clack on NPR's Car Talk program when they play Stump the Chump, and Linda is the stumper, and I get to be the chumper.
I'm glad you know your place.
But, Fred, what about with the jalapeno and the gherkin and all those different flavors? You can come up with something for that.
Didn't I just cry out for a tequila shooter?
That would be perfect.
Yes.
I think that would be fabulous. But anyway, this time, Linda, I'm waiting for you. I have not just one wine ice cream match, but several, and they're perfectly mainline. Nothing weird here. Well, nothing too weird. First, try this. Rum raisin ice cream. Mm. With Gonzales Baez extra sweet dessert dulce sherry from Spain, from the Pedro Ximenez grape. This dessert wine is made with grapes that are picked extra ripe and then laid on straw mats in the sun to evaporate most of their juices, just leaving nothing but sugars and acids. And it actually tastes like raisins itself. And it's so sweet and thick with sugar that you don't even have to sip it. They literally, in Spain, they pour it over the ice cream and have it just like chocolate sauce, and you can dazzle your guests, and it's only $18 a bottle.
It's really, really good, this type of shake.
Will that be on the website for people who want to?
Right, yeah. I'll put this up on the website. On the
blog. Willow Bend, that's your website, Linda. Will you have it there?
Anything for you, Fred.
Oh, I appreciate it. And just to show I can do this with one hand tied behind my back, I shall now reveal ice cream matches using sake, beer, and even scotch.
Oh.
First, sake. You serve coconut ice cream with a glass of Tyku, that's T-Y-K-U, coconut nigori sake. This is a sweet dessert sake. It's sweet and silky, and it's cloudy with rice and infused with coconut. So it goes perfectly with coconut ice cream, and it's only $20 a bottle. Now, beer. You might think it would be hard to match beer, but it's not. I actually have talked about this before. You take Reese's peanut butter ice cream, peanut butter pieces ice cream, and use chocolate stout by Rogue's Brewery in Oregon. This is a hearty, inky black stout that has real chocolate added to it. So you pour the stout in a big glass, plop in 2 scoops of the ice cream, and you have a perfect dry and lightly alcoholic adult float. And it's only $6 for a 22-ounce bottle. Finally, scotch. Now, this is counterintuitive, but it's absolutely delicious. My foodie friends Danny and Barbara introduced me to this. You take a big bowl of vanilla bean ice cream, really good quality stuff. You top it with a jigger of scotch, and you can use cheap scotch because you're going to adulterate it so much. And then you give it a teaspoon of finely ground dark-roasted Cuban espresso coffee beans.
Hmm.
It is. It doesn't sound that great, but it's just absolutely delicious. And I actually have a lot more matches, but I'm out of time. So if I can do a plug, just check my wine column in the Miami Herald next Thursday, and there'll be even more ice cream matches.
Wow.
And it just goes to show that they can make you grow old, but they can't make you grow up.
Thank you, Fred Tasker. Chef, did you have something you wanted to add to him? Okay, so I think we mentioned all the flavors that you've brought for us to taste.
Pretty much, yes.
But there's a sundae. There's an unbelievable sundae.
The sundae is a combination of strawberry rosewater ice cream, and this is a unique flavor, amaranth granola with a honey caramel swirl.
Mm. All this is in one glass?
Yes. Okay. Well, in a bowl. Yeah, served in a bowl. Right. And that's going to be served with fresh mint. You'll have caramel sauce. You'll have amaranth granola in there. And something unique is rose petals for a garnish.
Wow.
Can you eat rose petals?
Absolutely.
Oh. Yeah,
not
sure.
Like the rose petals that grow in your garden. Not they're edible rose petals.
If they haven't had any sprays on them.
They're pink.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no DDT preferably.
No.
Okay. So now tell us if we wanted to make ice cream at home.
Right.
So what are some tips for us?
Make sure the ones that are at home don't taste it before it gets in the freezer.
The people, oh, why? Because it won't be left for the freezer?
Exactly. Okay. Right. Seriously speaking, just make sure you follow your recipe, making sure that, you know, your freezers definitely have enough space in it. A lot of times people will make their ice cream in a packed freezer and it just doesn't get hard enough. So when they go to put the ice cream in the freezer, it's not. It's so packed that, you know, you can't freeze it. So it comes off like a soft serve, which is not bad.
You could decrease your freezer temperature before that.
That's a good idea as well, yes.
Right. And also, I think one thing people don't realize is once you've made the ice cream, no matter what kind of machine you've made it in or whatever, it really needs to mature. So you need to put it back in the freezer and let it stay for an hour or two.
That's right, absolutely. And also, a lot of people over churn their ice cream, which will then turn it into mush.
How do you know when to stop?
Usually, it's as soon as it starts to look like a soft serve ice cream, that's when you stop. Okay. A lot of times, people will just turn the switch on and then leave for the afternoon. So,
you know, my advice like is to get an electric ice cream maker, because if you ever hand churned it, it takes about 3 days to do it.
Yes, that's great. That's really the way to go. And some come with timers to do that as well.
All right. And we're almost out of time, but just a quick tip. If you're going to serve it to people, put your dishes in the freezer.
So then the ice cream
won't puddle when you put it on the dish when you're serving it. And it's been really a wonderful, tasty week. We could go on and on.
Indeed. Let's have him back sometime.
Thank you, James. Thank you.
This is one of our most popular Mexican festivals, so it's really, really popular.
Okay. Thank you.
That's Chef James Cawley. Thank you for joining us and for bringing us these wonderful treats. Rosa Mexicano Ice Cream Festival starts next Wednesday and it goes on through August 25th. And they're located on Lincoln Road?
On Lincoln Road in Mary Brickle Village.
In Mary Brickle Village. Fred Tasker, great advice as always. I knew I would win my bet.
Mail me some ice cream, okay?
Okay. I'll ask Chef to do that for you. Joe Cooper and Bonnie, you ate very well today.
Indeed.
Yes, you did.
It was fun.
Well, Fred's in Michigan, right?
Yes.
So we have an outpost there in Minneapolis. That's close to him.
Okay.
I'll be there this afternoon.
Next week will be our very popular one-hour restaurant roundabout with Jen Koretnik. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and program downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org, and more info as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell's South Florida Arts Beat, another of his patented live studio concert. Tomorrow, the Elastic Bond, world music. Monday, we talk about the 1960s campaign against California subversives. And to the calendar on this day in 1858, 155 years ago, Felix Mendelssohn's Wedding March is premiered at the marriage of Queen Victoria's daughter to the Crown Prince of Russia. It was composed as incidental music for A Midsummer Night's Dream. Bonnie can hum it. And on this day in 1874, 139 years ago, the birth of English novelist and poet William Somerset Maugham in Paris. During World War II, he was a member of the British Secret Service. Of Human Bondage, The Moon and Sixpence, The Razor's Edge. One more, I'll recall that FDR's bulletproof presidential limo once belonged to Scarface. On this day in 1947, 66 years ago, the death of Chicago gangster Al Capone at Palm Island, Florida, in Biscayne Bay, from complications of syphilis. He was 48. We leave with a thought from Maugham, reputedly the highest paid author of the 1930s. Quote, "Money is like a sixth sense. without which you cannot make a complete use of the other five. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer. Next, it's Here and Now from NPR News.